Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuckanauts, what the fuck bots, what the fuckadelics, what the fucksters? I am Mark Maron. This is WTF. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. Glad to be here. Happy to be in your head, sharing my brain with your ears and on into your soul. I got Blake Mills on the show today, guitar wizard. How did I come across Blake Mills? How did that happen? Well, I do know this about him. He's got a record out that I listen to. The song "If I'm Unworthy" kills me, just kills me. And I believe I'll get him to play it. But man, this guy is like, he's real earnest about guitar playing. But he's also one of these wizards that the sound is so perfect, and he honors the kind of the real tube and distortion and stuff that happens naturally in the electronics. I'm just fascinated with him, and it's a good conversation, especially if you're a guitar guy. if you're not, I think you'll still enjoy him. But he did just produce the new Alabama Shakes record, Sound and Color. I've been listening to a little of that, and it's sweet, sweet production, man. I mean, it's got that old R&B soul vibe to it, but it's also just kind of very beautifully defined by a wizard, and he's like 12 years old, this Blake Mills kid. It's always interesting to meet the young wizards, the guys who just, obviously they work and they do it, but some dudes and gals just have a knack, a God-given gift, for Christ's sake. Maybe it's just the luck of the draw, genetic rolling of the dice, the tumbling down the DNA strands into pure brilliance on those guitar strings. Who knows? I don't. I do all right. I was just playing a bit before I cranked on the mics. So what is happening, man? So I did the Toronto shows. That was the night after I talked to you last. I did two shows in Toronto up there in Canada, and they were fucking awesome. The tour has just been great. I'm so grateful people are coming out. And I had a good time in Toronto. I did the new Q show on CBC. It's their big radio program. It's an interview show. I did the premiere episode with the new host, Shad. And that was pretty great. It's rare that, like, a lot of times I do interviews, but when I get interviewed, I got moved, you know. There was some good moments there, and it was in front of a live audience. You should look that up. It's Q with Shad, and I'm the guest. And there were some other guests there. It was a great guitar player. Now I'm going to forget everyone's name, and a great poet. The poet's name is Shane Koizan, I think, K-O-Y-C-Z-A-N. And I really liked him. He's a great guy, great reader. He recited his piece, and he gave me a book, and they're delightful poems. And the guitar player was this guy, Bahamas. I think his real name is Afi Jervanin. And I was backstage with this dude, and he had this like 52 Strat, which is a rare piece, man. It was just amazing. And the stage was beautiful in the CBC there. I'm not sure what the facility was, but it was amazing. And Shad did a good job. Yeah, I'd done the show a couple of times with the past host, Gian Gomeshi, who is in trouble. Got himself into some trouble and doesn't look good. But nonetheless, I had a great time doing that. And I did the Global Morning Show in Toronto. It's always exciting to do morning shows when you're up at 7:30 and you're sitting there with four or five perky hosts just going at it for like 4 minutes. and you're out. That's it. But all in all, I love going to Canada, and I did what I do sometimes, and now I'm not going to be able to do it now after I talk about it, but I always buy like a few Cuban cigars because they're legal up there. Maybe eventually they'll be legal here. I hope not, because I still consider them a treat, and I don't want to get strung out on the fucking cigars. And I'll take like, you know, four or five of them out of Canada. I feel like the guy in Midnight Express. Like, I might as well have two or three hashish belts on, and in any moment I'm going to be thrown into some horrendous Canadian prison where I'm locked in the basement. That and I just, I eventually walk the wrong way and piss everybody off and figure out a way to get out by throwing the warden up on a coat hook by accident, and then just walk out, just steal an outfit and walk out. I got it all planned out, but now the cat's out of the bag. So when they put me in the lockup, they know how I'm going to get out. I'm never going to take Cubans out of the country again. That was it. It's over. Also got this letter. I don't know when I said this. I guess it was like last week. Hi, Mark. My name is Bobby, and I am the woman with laryngitis in Philly that you mentioned during your intro to the Henry Winkler Show. I wanted to respond to your implication that I might have caused your voice weakness during the intro. I'm willing to take the blame for that. However, I don't feel that I am responsible for a few reasons. A, your voice didn't sound very bad during the intro, and I could barely speak above a whisper. Two, I'm pretty sure that my laryngitis was caused by allergies. Three, you did 5 shows in 3 nights just prior to recording your intro. Now, here's where the loyal fan part comes in. Nevertheless, if you would like to blame me, I have broad shoulders, and also it is fun to be mentioned on your podcast, so I'll be happy to accept responsibility. By the way, the show is terrific, and my brother and I thoroughly enjoyed it. Thanks for keeping us entertained, Bobby. Well, it didn't turn out I had that laryngitis, Bobby. Everything worked out. Oh, my God. Yeah, I got pretty strung out, man. I'm doing all these shows. I put everything I got into it. Beats me up. I woke up in Toronto with chest pains. Yeah, that was exciting. And then you start to realize, you know, I'm not always so clear on how old I am or what's happening, but you know, you can have a heart blast. You can have a heart attack at 51, at 48, at 37, whenever the fuck it is. But, you know, I also have a tremendous amount of anxiety that I maintain and nourish on a day-to-day basis, a good amount of dread, and a lot of repressed anger. Am I working this shit out? Yeah, there's a lot of things that I have solved as of late. I feel okay about who I am in the world and what I'm doing for the most part. Occasionally, I will be attacked by a fit of jealousy for something I don't want. For someone that I don't care about, against what, I don't know. Why does that happen? Jealousy and self-loathing is like inverted competitive spirit. It's like, you know, I'm competitive, but I don't think I can win, so I'm just going to fight with myself and see who wins that battle. There's no winning, because the loser is you. And depending on what course that takes, who the fuck knows? You can have a battle to the death with yourself. Oh, by the way, I'm going to be in Austin, Texas tonight. This is at Moon Tower Comedy Fest. I'll be there. I'm doing a screening of a Marin episode. That's so it'll effectively premiere there with a Q&A. And then I'm doing a live Dr. Katz reunion of sorts with Jonathan Katz. That's at Moon Tower. And then Saturday, Houston, Fitzgerald's, 26th in Dallas. Oh, you can still get tickets to Dallas. For some reason, Dallas is not one of my stronger cities. I'm happy that some of Texas likes me. I can't expect everyone to like me. But the Dallas gig, the Southside Music Hall, still tickets available for that. Friday, May 8th, the Neptune in Seattle, the late show, still some available. And May 9th at the Vogue in Vancouver, some tickets available. May 10th, San Francisco, Davey Symphony Hall. Definitely tickets available. The Orange Peel, that's in Asheville, North Carolina. Late show available. Charleston Music Hall in Charleston, South Carolina. Still a few tickets left. Variety Playhouse in Atlanta, still some left. Joy Theater, New Orleans, few left. There you go. Oh, you know what? Def Black Cat came back. It's been like months, you guys. He was making funny noises the last time I saw him, like he had something stuck in his nose. There was like maybe one of those burrs, and there was nothing I could do to get him. He was very infrequent and not consistent in terms of how much I fed him, but he was usually around, and then he just disappeared. And again, I grieved this motherfucker. I grieved him. And then I just saw him for a split second on my deck, and I was like, are you fucking kidding me? Are you kidding me? He ran away when he saw me, but He's still, I don't know where he's been. This is the deaf cat. This is the baddest cat in the fucking world. And I thought he'd been done in by whatever. But he was back, man. The journey continues with Deaf Black Cat. Big Head, Big Balls Cat, he's around. The black, I'm calling him Big Head because his head's oversized and he's got oversized balls. He's around. He seems to be like, I don't know. I think he threw up a bird the other day. Not great. Not great. Scaredy Cat's back on the deck. He's been coming around for a decade. There's a couple of new younger cats coming around. I don't know. Maybe there's a litter somewhere. They're definitely wild. Totally new one came by last night. Tuxedo Cat. We'll see if they keep coming. They're all doing all right. Monkey and LaFonda are fine. Happy as hell. And that's the cat report. All right? It's a little tweaky for them when I go away for a couple of days and I come back and they have to readjust to my, you know, frenetic intensity, which makes them uncomfortable. Hey, look, they could have gone somewhere else. You know, they could have died in an alleyway. But no, they just have to deal with a neurotic, aggravated man who takes care of them and wrestles with his love for them. All right, let's talk to Blake Mills, the youngin, the youngster, the young guitar wizard and producer.
Lee Sklar, the bass player, has a switch on his bass that...
You don't know what the switch is.
It doesn't do anything. It's confirmed it doesn't do... You know what it did is when a producer or an engineer would walk into the room and say, it's not quite, it needs a something, and he would flip the switch, and they would go, that's perfect. It worked.
It was a buffer.
Yeah, totally.
Between him and the producer.
Totally. Yeah. Well, what we did was we took an amplifier, and we... tricked the amplifier into thinking that it was seeing a speaker, you know? So like you've got the tubes and the preamp and power amp and all this stuff, and then that all sends to a speaker.
Right.
And if it's not connected to a speaker, it'll freak out. You know what I mean? It's like plugging up a hose or something.
Right.
So we created a way to create like a speaker impedance, but no speaker. We just took the amp and sent it straight into a DI, into the board.
Really?
Yeah. So that crazy distortion you hear on Revolution, you know, the Beatles, when they plug straight into the desk and just distorted the channel. It's kind of like that, but it's even another, you know, stage of distortion. And
it's a great sound. It's
thanks.
A great record.
Thank you.
I really liked it. I mean, I put it, like, I had it for a while, and I didn't know who you were, and I'm like, no, I'm going to put this on. And then, like, I put it on, I'm like, what's happening? What the fuck is happening? Who's this guy?
It's a weird record.
No, definitely. It's not that it's a weird record. It's very grounded in something very American sounding. Like there was a few, like at least in those first few songs, like the second tune, sounds like a Randy Newman song almost.
Sure. Oh yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there is that foundation in what I know as sort of not traditional American music, but definitely roots music.
Yeah.
Was that there for you?
Yeah. I mean, I've spent a large part of my life listening to a lot of those guys, and especially Randy Newman. You know?
Why him?
Well, he's kind of one of the top tier ultimate American songwriters,
isn't he?
I mean, it's like Dylan and Tom Waits and Randy Newman, you know. And then like if you go a little further north and include like guys like Neil Young and Leonard Cohen, you start to get a picture of who in the last 50 years have kind of shaped American songwriting.
Is it interesting, you know? The guys that you say that you mentioned there are like, you can listen to at least the first five or six Randy Newman albums and they're timeless. You can listen to almost any Neil Young record and it transcends time.
Yeah.
Dylan as well.
Yeah.
I mean, stylistically there are some shifts, but it doesn't seem to age. It's its own thing.
No, when they're firing lyrically, especially like the Leonard Cohen records that a lot of people shy away from because the production is guilty of like being dated or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't realize that he was completely on top of his game lyrically.
I keep trying
even more
to listen to him.
Even more, as on a whole.
Well, I've never been like I'm a fucking Leonard Cohen guy.
Uh-huh.
And like I listened the other night, I listened to songs about love and hate. all the way through. And I've listened to songs from A Room, and I keep trying, and I understand the poetry of it, and I like it.
Yeah.
But it still doesn't grab me like it should.
It doesn't feel like the kind of thing you want to just be alone with listen, in
yeah.
a room.
Well, I, it does, but there's something like, it's not even, it's not the emotions of it. I like the sort of gypsy music sometimes that he does, or wherever that's from, because nothing sounds like whoever played guitar on some of those records. But his lyrics, I understand the poetry of them and I feel it, but I don't feel the emotions of it. It doesn't connect with me. Hmm. I'm not feeling the rage, or I'm not feeling like, you know, with Neil Young or with Dylan or with Randy Newman, there's definitely an edge to some of that shit.
Sure.
And I feel like that Cohen is reaching for something different.
Hmm. Well, it's presented in maybe a different, it's sophisticated.
Yeah,
you know? It certainly is. But there's something beautiful about the lack of sophistication in the delivery.
Yeah.
Of his early records.
Yeah,
you know. So you've got that dichotomy, and then as the records get cleaner, the writing actually gets a little more focused. You know, like there's a record he's got called Various Positions, and it sounds like the demo button on a Casio keyboard.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
The lyrics are.
Solid.
Are so, yeah, it's like the there's just so much in each stroke, you know, each brush stroke.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I like, you know, I like Suzanne and I like Sisters of Mercy. And I like that period.
Sure.
I mean, that shit's great.
Beautiful.
I mean, it's beautiful music he's actually singing at a pretty good level.
But what gets me is like, I'm Your Man.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It starts to get so kind of crummy and seedy.
Okay. All right.
That's pretty cool to have wrapped in a package that sounds like.
I think I just got to
intro to a newscast or something.
Yeah. Like I got to do it more. I got to do more Cohen.
Fall things.
I just got to sit with it more.
Yeah.
But when did you start? When did you? Because I know we were both at the Derek Truck show.
Yeah.
Tedeschi and Trucks. And I missed
Amazing,
you.
Amazing, wasn't it?
Where's that guy come from?
All over.
He's like a savant or something. Well, but you're kind of like that too. Do you go to one of those shows where you guys sort of like, you know, you guys are at a level? And did you talk to him after?
I did. Yeah.
What'd you talk to him about?
How beautiful the show was. It was just a. You know what I noticed was, I mean, that's a big band. There's a lot of power
tight
behind
as fuck.
That band.
So good.
Yeah. I mean, it's like it has an engine.
Yeah.
And I've played at the Greek before, and I've seen shows at the Greek before, and it's an outdoor venue that is situated in a neighborhood, and the residents of the neighborhood have successfully managed to keep the decibel limit,
you know,
at a certain point where if you cross it, you've got to pay a lot of money.
Is that true?
Fine. Oh yeah, and it's pretty low. Like I've gone to shows there and felt like it was just there was a lack of energy there, but at that show, man, they've. It didn't feel quiet. It felt like he was cranking and his tones were so interesting.
And
for
he's
a
conducting
live show.
Too. That's
completely,
the interesting thing.
Like, completely.
Yeah, well, that's what I noticed is that he is like.
And a guy who doesn't really, he's not the most animated guitar player
by
any stretch. You know, he pretty much, you know, like tunes in and he's in the zone for the whole show. But everybody's watching him and what they aren't seeing, they're hearing. And
so
I think
when
Derek
did you start playing?
I was 10. I started playing.
And you grew up where?
I grew up in Malibu.
You grew up in Malibu?
Yeah.
Like, are your parents like old Malibu residents?
Kind of. My dad actually lived on Topanga Beach through the 70s.
Is he a music guy?
A huge music lover.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And my mom...
He's not in show
Chatsworth.
Business?
No. He sold real estate.
Yeah?
My mom's a paralegal.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
So you just grew up down there by the beach?
Yeah, down by the beach.
Down by Dylan's house?
Kinda. I didn't know it was Dylan's house at the time, but I had a lot of friends out there.
The one that looks like
a
mosque.
There's like a gate up there.
I don't know. I don't know anything about
it. I've never been to Bob's house up there.
And who, are you friends with those? Are you friends with Jacob or anything?
Yeah. I've known Jacob for, I don't know, maybe I was like 20 or something when I met him. We were working on his first solo record together.
You were playing on it?
Yeah. In fact, I was kind of... there was a stage of him making that record where we were working with a very good friend of mine named Tony Berg, who I grew up with working with, as a producer, and Jacob and Tony were working on Jacob's material, and I came in and kind of built demos, sort of, you know, just like played everything, and then we went and tracked it, and we tracked, and that was the first time I'd played with Jim Keltner on that
How
session.
Old were you?
I'm guessing I was probably 20. I don't know. I could be.
So let's chart the wizardry, if we could.
if you don't promise not to use that word.
All right. I know you're humble, but I mean, at some point you've got to, like, you know, you're okay. I won't use that word. Fine. So you're 10 years old. The first guitar you get is what?
Strat. A Squire Strat.
You got a Squire Strat?
Yeah, Sunburst. It's still in pieces in my mom's garage.
And who bought that for you?
My dad.
And now, when you picked it up, you didn't have an acoustic. You started on electric.
Yeah, I started on electric because the only reason I really wanted to play guitar was because Kurt Cobain just looked so fucking cool.
That was it. You're 10 years old and you're like, that's
I was it. Totally seduced by music videos.
And what did he play, though? He played a jazz master or something?
Yeah, but I mean, to be unintroduced, there's no, you know, there's no difference.
No, right. But to be like, he played with like Piano Wire or something. It's like...
And the guitar was so low.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was such an iconic image of this guy playing this thing and stooped over and the hair in his face and the sound of his voice and guitar.
It's a real deal, that guy.
Completely.
It's weird because it took me years to realize that, you know, you play what you play, but it's your commitment to, you know, what you play and how you play that really is going to transcend anything.
Yeah.
Because there are guys that...
If you believe it.
Yeah, exactly. If you believe it, that's the magic, isn't it?
Totally. And when we were talking about J.J. Cale earlier and the level of difficulty or technicality in his playing and there's something that a lot of people they'll glance over when they're learning something, and it's feel and touch.
Yeah,
because there aren't a lot of words or ways to document or notate, describe the touch of how something was played.
Right.
You know, so a lot of people will learn a figure, but there's still this huge part of it that they haven't got.
Right.
You know, and that's a how do you, where do you, yeah, totally. Where does that fall on the hierarchical chart of, you know, what's good and what's difficult?
Also because there's so many, like when you're playing an amplified instrument, there's a whole range of things that you can get out of that without changing a note.
And an acoustic. I mean, the guys that can get that out of an acoustic instrument is even more impressive.
Yeah.
You know?
So when you start playing your Strat, what are you playing? Do you, like, who teaches you initially?
Well, the store that I bought the guitar from offered guitar lessons, and that you could get like 10 free lessons if you bought a guitar from them. So there was a fellow by the name of Ralph who had like Kirk Hammett hair and showed me, you know, like the greatest hits from the Black Album and Soundgarden and the Nirvana songs that I wanted to learn. And I walked out of there being able to play, you know, Come As You Are. And it's like the foundation for all of the guitar playing that I do today. Still,
really?
I mean, even though I've gone on like such an interesting journey as far as discovering other kinds of music and just being turned on to stuff, I still find myself when I pick up a guitar falling onto these sort of two note couplings, you know, these shapes.
Yeah.
And they're all over the Nirvana records, those shapes.
That was it.
Yeah.
That laid it down for you.
Yeah, whether I knew it or not, you know, I mean, there's a lot of musicality in like you know, the Pinkerton record, the Weezer Pinkerton record.
Oh yeah, well, he's a monster guitar player
and a writer, you know. Yeah. And so if you and my dad used to have these musician friends who he grew up with in the 70s, guitar players, and they would come over to the house and ask what I was listening to, and I'd put on Pinkerton. And it wasn't the kind of disconnect that, you know, a lot of parents, you know, the generational gap. They were going, okay, there's music in this, and they would listen and be able to go, okay, yeah, it's a one. The progression is 1-5-6-4. You know, and that seemed like such a magic trick to be able to not have a guitar or an instrument around and listen to a piece of music and go, I understand what's going on here.
And you picked that up.
Well, I saw that was happening.
Right.
So I want to do that, you know?
Yeah,
I want to
be
able to, that's
cool. Those guys. I want to be able to do that.
It's to see that. I used to go in my garage and I would play handball against, you know, by myself and against the wall. And I would fantasize, because I wasn't a very popular kid when I was in elementary school. I would fantasize like, well, what if there was this competition, right? Where it was like I was representing my school or my these people that didn't really know who I was, but I was the handball wizard, and I could just do these things. And I was, and I'm playing down there in the garage, yeah, you know, past 10 o'clock, and hitting this thing, going, wouldn't that be great if I was just able to do something that that nobody else was able to do?
But initially, it was handball. I'm glad you decided on guitar eventually.
Yeah, because there still isn't a handball Olympics in the Santa Monica Malibu Unified School District. You would try as we might.
You would have been just the weird kid that could play handball really well.
Well, I think I probably still was. But
what were you, just like quiet or
not? Really quiet. I think I was actually kind of a little shit.
Oh.
My mom has a collection of, they were called pink slips, things you would get when you get in trouble.
Oh, really? Yeah. You're a smart ass?
Yeah, I was probably really hard to deal with. My principal in elementary school said he'll be in jail by the time he's 20.
Oh, really?
Which is funny, because once I hit like 14
and
everybody else was starting to get into mischief,
I
was so sort of focused and obsessed with music that I became an adult.
It wasn't even an option.
It just didn't. A neighbor turned me on to pot when I was 10.
Yeah.
And I started smoking when I was 10. And then by the time I was 14, I was going out. I was hanging out with people who were in and out of rehab, and I just lost interest.
You were done with it.
Yeah.
Is it interesting, though, because you never then bought into this idea about rock and roll or music, that because so many of the people that I look up to, and I'm sure you as well, were disasters, with drugs and alcohol.
Yeah.
And you somehow avoided making the connection,
right?
Like thinking that was necessary.
It's one of the things that I would attribute to growing up in Malibu.
Oh, really?
Well, because you're around, you're in proximity to some of that, to see the reality of it. It's no longer this thing on a poster. On
the broken people.
Totally. Like, you know, the people I was playing music with were in their, you know, late 20s, maybe early 30s at the time, and their idols did all the stuff that you're talking about, right?
Right.
And so that was the excuse for the behavior that I was seeing, that was clearly not something that was glamorous, you know,
or adding to the music
at all. I mean, I would join a band to replace a guy who would be in rehab.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he was one of my favorite, still is one of my favorite guitar players.
Is he still playing?
Yeah, and he's doing really well.
Oh, good.
Really well. He's great. He's sober. He's, you know, like, I think he's living in Malibu again. He's doing yoga every day. It's fucking great.
Is he a big, he's a big guy?
No. I mean, what do you mean big?
Like he's in a big band?
No, but his father was a heavy, still is a heavy guitar player.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's cool.
I mean, I don't think he would mind me saying it's Dwayne Betts, Dickie Betts'
son. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I grew up playing with him and the band that he was in, and it was like a Southern rock band with a bunch of really talented, famous people's kids.
Uh-huh.
And
who was in that band?
Roy Orbison's son was playing drums.
Really?
Alex.
Yeah.
Dwayne was in the band. At one point, Barry Oakley Jr.'s...
Was he named after Dwayne?
Yeah.
That's great. That's the Allman Brothers family. The band as a family is
pretty
really,
tight-knit.
It's wild to me, man.
It's pretty wild. I brought a guitar that'll freak you out.
Oh, yeah?
It was a gift from Dickie.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is he still down there?
He's in Florida.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. And Dwayne plays with him. Dwayne's playing with Dickie now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they play together in the Great Southern.
Yeah, I don't know what happened between him and the Allmans, but whatever.
What happens between people
bands.
In all bands?
Yeah, I guess
the inevitable collapse of this idea that things can be democratic
forever. It's so wild. I just was listening to the Dwayne Allman anthology. I got both of them. And there's some stuff on there, man, where like I didn't really realize the full scope of it, but there's an 8-minute... blues number where he's not playing slides, he's just playing straight up. Like the feel is just insane. So young too.
Yeah.
He died. He wasn't even 30.
I don't know.
It's
remember.
It's crazy. Doesn't that blow you away?
It is. It's nuts to like consider what these guys were capable of doing
at that age.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Well, not even at the age, but just in such a short amount of time.
Right.
You know, the conversation like Dwayne,
because you're 28, right?
I'm 28.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like Dwayne, I think, eludes a lot of musicians as far as, like, you know, why he's held in such esteem. And I was actually having that conversation with my friend Tony Berg the other day, and found myself struggling to kind of get him across, you know, and do him justice, because there's something kind of intangible about just the fire he's playing. And on top of that, there have been so many people since Dwayne, he's influenced so many people that have taken that and kind of right out of the gate, just been, you know, like played with that sort of intensity. And it's nowhere near as thrilling as when you have to go on that 8-minute journey, like you're talking about, to arrive there with him.
Yeah.
There's something to be said for that. And I don't know that there were a lot of players that were playing like that at the time. So
I think that's true.
The context is also something to place things in, to fully understand what these guys were doing.
Okay, so you're 10, you're going through elementary school, you're playing Nirvana, and then like when you get into these bands, you're in high school by then?
Yeah, I was in middle school.
Who are your guys then? Like in terms of...
When
like,
I was 14, I think I heard Derek. Somebody put me a bootleg of a Derek Trucks Band concert, and it finally...
Is he that much older than you?
He's a little bit older. I don't know how much older. I mean, he was probably like around my age at the time. And it was one of the reasons it was so big for me is because at the time I had been playing with a guy named Bob Brosman, who's no longer with us, but he was a world music he was an ethnomusicologist, and he was really big in making records that would come out in the world music genre. He would just go around to different countries and make records with not much like Ry Cooter does, you know, where he'll go and make kind of like a record with this person that celebrates the indigenous music of that person and that culture. So Bob Brosman made a living doing that, but he would play exclusively national resophonic guitars, the metal acoustic guitars.
Like a dobro.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I saw him, my dad took me to see a show of him playing like McCabe's or something like that, and he would do seminars at his house in Santa Cruz, and after the show my dad took me over and asked if we could attend one of the seminars, and so my dad drove me up to Santa Cruz.
How old were you?
I think I was maybe 13, 12 or 13. And my dad drove me up to Santa Cruz, which is quite a drive. That's like a 6-hour drive or something like that.
Yeah, trippy place.
Totally trippy. Yeah. And so we went to his house, and you know, there was like 10 old guys in sandals and cargo shorts, hunched over in a circle and learning, you know, like Blind Blake riffs and stuff. But I think Bob could see that I was interested in the world music aspect of his playing. I was just really enamored with the sounds of other instruments, and he made
like
a record.
Which ones?
Well, he made a record with this guy Jelly Musa Jawara.
Uh-huh.
Musa Jawara, I think I'm pronouncing that right. And he's a guy from Mali, African musician who played kora.
Uh-huh.
Kora is like a harp.
Yeah, I've seen those things.
They're
really
impressive.
Aren't
looking.
They in Senegal too?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I know. Yeah. Like Baba Mal and
Exactly. Oh, so they're these. It's a gourd with a pole and leather straps. That
hell of a sound.
It's
kind of vibrates.
So intoxicating.
And, yeah.
And all the notes ring across each other and stuff.
Yeah.
And so I fell in love with the sound of that instrument and became fascinated with the idea of trying to get a guitar to sound like that. It's sort of like I had become familiar enough with a guitar that it'd be easier for me to try to coax some of that out of the instrument than to pick. And I got a kora, and it's like, you know,
can you play it
walking on a hammock? I mean, it's so hard to, it takes so much finesse and a different sort of connection between your two hands than guitar requires. Kind of like piano. Piano sort of backwards for
guitar
player.
Do you play piano?
Barely. Not
how's the kora coming?
I'm closer on a guitar than a kora.
Yeah.
And the kora actually.
So you're 13. You're this kid.
13. I'm in love with music from all over the world. But I'm also really starting to come of age and appreciate the Rolling Stones and also like contemporary rock music. Like, I mean, I remember being a huge fan of me and my old bandmates would listen to like Third Eye Blind. I mean, and Phantom Planet and all kinds of like pop songwriting and stuff. But at that age, they felt very, you know, they felt like I had to keep one a secret from the other.
But did that guy see you as a gifted guy?
I think so. I mean, I think in ways he was a little disappointed that I didn't carry the torch in the naturalist way that he had.
So you
for
kept
so long.
In touch with him?
Yeah, I kept in touch, but I would say I fell out of touch.
Uh-huh.
You know, when I decided to start playing electric guitar in a band with drums and when he caught wind of that, I think he was a little heartbroken.
But he took you under his wing to a degree for
before
a few
that.
Years?
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of the slide playing came from that period. Because
what's
he
his
was a
name?
Slide player. Bob Brosman. And if you look up videos of him, his shows were kind of academic. You know, he would because he was a professor at UCLA or like an ethnomusicologist that they would come in and do seminars and stuff.
You're in this band with Orbison's kid and Derek or Dwayne.
Yeah, Dwayne.
And you and who else?
And the writer and singer of the band, his father is a guy named Jerry Lynn Williams, who's a songwriter. He wrote a couple of things for Clapton, I think.
And that was your first band?
That was the first band that I played
with. And how old were you?
I was 14.
Uh-huh.
And I was filling in for Dwayne when he would get sick or he would go into rehab or something.
Right.
And I didn't fully comprehend the heaviness of that, but I was just, I get to play like one of my favorite guitar players. I get to play like Dwayne, you know, with the band. It's great. So then he was fine. He would get out of rehab and then they would just keep me in because there's no limit to how many guitars you can have in a Southern rock band. So
yeah, the more the merrier.
Yeah.
Well, you want to do a couple now? You want
to
plug in?
Sure, yeah. Let me continue setting this stuff up. Around the time I graduated high school, Gibson was doing a signature model. They were doing a signature model of Dickie Betts guitars.
Right.
And
Les Paul.
Yeah, Les Paul. That was built in basically trying to copy the gold top Les Paul that he had. The gold finish had all flaked off.
Uh-huh.
So underneath the gold top, there's like a lacquer.
Yeah.
And it's this color.
That's
crazy
it?
Red. Yeah.
That's it.
So look at all this shit on here. Look at the input jack.
Oh, my God.
All stuff that he made. And so
that's one that they made for him. That's not the original.
Yeah, this is a prototype. Dickie Betts prototype. See on the
that's
top
wild,
of
dude.
And so he gifted it to me when I graduated high school, and a few years later, I kind of realized the significance of the gift and the importance of this guitar, and said I'm not going to tour it with it or play it anymore. I'm going to keep it safe.
What was the significance?
That it's a gift from one of the, you know, coolest guitar players of all time, and and it's rare and a special instrument. And so I went down to Guitar Center in Hollywood, the Vintage Room, and I brought this and set about trying to find a Les Paul that sounded better, you know, that I could invest some dough in and go, okay, this will be my instrument that I use, and then this will be safe, and I'll put
find
it away.
One?
No, this thing killed every guitar that was in there. Just slayed it. It's so much
better.
How
do you determine that?
With your ears, you know?
But I mean, like, those are straight up
humbuckers.
They're like
burst bucker pickups. They make, you know, they make different ones.
Yeah.
But
there's just the magic of that wood, huh?
Totally. Well, the wood, the combination of everything together. I mean, I guess.
Each one can be magic, right?
Totally. I mean, like, you could have three consecutive instruments, you know, like built consecutively, and then they may not have any resemblance to each other.
Yeah.
Or like, you could be in the studio with a band, and they do three takes in a row.
Yeah.
And there's a reason why, you know, hopefully one of those takes will be the one, you know, because the other two aren't.
Yeah.
You know, like there's no rhyme or reason to it beyond.
But you seem like a guy that's attached to very specific instruments, but do you have a lot of them, or are you committed to
it's starting to pile up. Because I use them for such different things, and I start to get obsessed with, I started to get obsessed with application, you know, like, I mean, I just found this acoustic instrument that projects like an electric instrument.
Yeah.
And they don't all do that. And so when you start to realize, and you've been in a situation where you're playing an acoustic instrument in a room and you're just fighting to get your idea out, you start going, okay, there's a problem. It's like the way like an inventor's mind might look at it. So the problem's identified. Now you might go 25 years before you come across an instrument that solves that problem. And it might not be until you play that instrument that you even were aware that the problem existed. You could just go, oh man, I can play, when I go to Largo and I sit in with these guys, this will be the perfect instrument for me to play, and I no longer have to lug around, you know,
right,
an electric guitar so that I can play along with the, you know, the violin and mandolin. It's,
who do you play with over there? Who's the violin? Ben Mott and those guys?
Yeah, Ben Mott and the Watkins, and I went and saw John Bryan the other night and played a little with him. It was beautiful, and yeah, I mean, he's got he had like a collection of acoustic guitars and I think a 67 mic, like it was a recording session, you know, and he mic'd it like a recording session. And if you don't have an instrument that makes that mic react or then you're just kind of going uphill.
I got a thing that I bought when I was looking for that. I wanted to get a J45, and I just couldn't find a new one that sounded good. And eventually, I just got one. It was chosen for me. Uh-huh. I got a deal on it from Gibson. But I bought this weird FJN. Have you seen those things?
No, I don't know what that is.
It's this big body guitar with two white flamenco pick guards on it. I think with a short classical neck. I think
steel string or
steel.
Yeah.
I think Jackson Browne plays them. So I got one of those, and it's the biggest sound I ever heard out of an acoustic. But I didn't. I think there was something a little off about it. It still needs to be set up properly, but it's amazing.
Just the playability, you mean?
Yeah, there's some buzzes to it I couldn't quite get out. And the neck's really short and fat because it's like a classical neck.
Yeah. And wide.
Yeah, I think it was made to transition classical players out of classical instruments into folk instruments or into steel string instruments.
In the 30s, they were making a guitar that was made for Hawaiian style, for slide playing, for slack key, and for slack key, it's what it sounds like. You tune the strings way down.
Right.
They have a bunch of slack. So having that space between each string was part of the design for those sort of features. And it has like a classical neck, but it has a V shape on the back. And it's I just found one. And it's that instrument I'm talking about that projects like an electric. It's an HG00. And it's unbelievable. I was totally unaware, unfamiliar with these guitars. And my friend said, again, Tony Berg, he's keeping a good eye out for me for instruments over the years and gigs and stuff. And he said, you should go down and hear this guitar. And I went and played it and fucking swiped it, man. He had it on hold. And I was like, you aren't getting this guitar.
And that's the one.
That's the new
Magic guitar.
Because a lot of them don't do that. A lot of that year, they kind of fold in on themselves if you start picking harder.
Right.
It doesn't get any louder. It just kind of compresses.
And that one does?
It gets louder.
Oh.
There's like extra headroom in it. It doesn't make any sense.
It's just you lucked out.
Totally.
Is that thing plugged in?
Let's see. I did the Crossroads Festival, Clapton Crossroads Festival.
Did you play with Eric?
Yeah. Well, I mean, he invites everybody that's there, and so I went and played. I sat in with Booker T and the MGs.
Great.
Yeah, another maestro. You know,
dude, it's like
he and Keith.
50 years of it's crazy. 70 years.
So deep. And a guitar player. He's a badass guitar player.
Really?
He was a guitar player before.
I thought he was
a tuba player. Well, maybe that too. Yeah. I don't know. But he was a guitar player at the time that they asked him to play organ on a session.
So what's your dad think of all your success?
He's very proud.
Yeah?
He's a happy dude.
Yeah.
When I was making Hi Ho, I got to a point where I felt comfortable showing him, and having him come down to the studio and some of the people that I was that were playing on that record were people who, if he wasn't familiar with their names, he knew they were playing.
Like who?
Jim Keltner, uh-huh. Don Was.
Uh-huh.
And he came down and his reaction was, that was enough for me. I got what I needed to get out of the experience of, making the record and having anybody getting any kind of feedback on it.
Just seeing him?
Yeah. Seeing him react to it.
That's
was
beautiful.
Really a heavy experience.
And your mom?
My mom's funnier. My mom's, she loves it.
Yeah.
It's great, but she's always asking me questions about what lyrics mean. And she's on.
Like, what does that mean?
Yeah, and I go, you don't want to know. And she's my mom's on Facebook, so she's doing all the wonderful, paternal promotion stuff.
Well, what's Don Was's magic? Because he's everywhere and always has been, it seems. What is great about him?
All right. Well, as a musician, one way you could describe it is let's look at it like, okay, on this record, Don was playing bass on a few songs, and on a couple other ones, Mike Elizondo was playing bass. The drummer was always Jim Keltner. The difference in who Jim was and what Jim did from when he was playing with Don and when he was playing with Mike kind of helps you see what both of those guys are about and Jim, but it does help you see the difference a bass player makes, you know, and just his touch and when he decides to pull a note so hard that it goes sort of sharp and kind of buzzes against the neck, the rhythm of that buzz, and the economy of notes uh-huh. and feel and everything. It does start to get a little esoteric, you know, to describe the kind of musician he is. But it's a beautiful thing to be, you know, to be able to play with a trio and have so much music and information come out from three guys. You know,
and a lot of it's just after a certain point is feel.
Totally.
Yeah.
I mean, kind of everything, really.
Right.
Because yeah, the note choice, you know, and what you don't play and stuff is huge, but the language that everything, you know, leaves the brain and gets to the ear, I mean, that's the feel part
right.
of it that
so
comes into play.
So once you sort of move through, you know, your high school band, mm-hmm. and then, you know, how in opening your mind up to world music and these other instruments and trying to make your guitar sound like things, I mean, what was the real goal for you? I mean, when did you, you know, start... Did you have another band after that band?
I was in a band called Simon Dawes, and those guys are still playing together.
Are they Dawes?
Yeah, they're Dawes.
People like them. I played the record. I don't know if it really connected with it, but I know that people love them. So you were with those guys.
I was with those guys, and when we were in a band together, we were listening to like the Kinks. First we were listening to like Steely Dan. We were in high school, and it was really uncool to listen and like.
You like Steely Dan?
I did. I mean, I still do. But not for the same reasons that I did when I was in high school.
For production reasons?
Just, yeah. I mean, some of the slyness in Fagan's writing and how bizarre that music is and feels when you put it on.
Yeah.
It no longer, to me, like when we started a band, the archetype for it was like, well, what if there was a band that like presented themselves like the Strokes? You know, they like stumbled on stage, but then they sounded like Steely Dan. How cool would that be? And to me, that was like the
right.
you know,
yeah,
the coolest.
Why didn't that band work out for you?
Well, for a while it did. I mean that was like the some of the most I learned a lot.
Yeah,
you know, but for the reasons why I think most bands ultimately don't work, it kind of crumbled. Like it went from being a time where two people who were coming of age and discovering records together were then writing and making music inspired by those records. It went from that to two people who were listening to pretty drastically different things and writing different things, but feeling like there was this design of the band where it wasn't a band song until both of us had made our stamp, you know?
Right.
And we hadn't really figured out we hadn't matured enough to know like if one of us had brought an idea and it was complete and fully founded to have the stamp be that's great and I fully endorse it, you know.
And
I
mean, when did you start doing session work?
After I left that band.
How did that start?
Tony Berg again. He's sort of like a mentor, and he'd produced the Simon Dawes record.
He's
got a studio in his backyard, home studio that he sometimes does sessions in, and so he would call me to play on stuff. And
Like who were your first sessions?
I played on a Jessica Hoop record, uh-huh. which is fun because she's an alien. She's out there.
Yeah,
she's so good, and very musical, I played with Jacob Dylan there.
Right.
We did there was this like Amnesty International, you know, charity record, and Jacob did everybody was doing John Lennon songs. That was the theme. Jacob did "Give Me Some Truth."
Yeah,
and Danny Harrison sang background vocals on it, and I played
that's George's
solo.
Son.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it was and George had played the original slide solo on
uh-huh.
that record. Beautiful solo, and so I played slide on that. And that's how I met Danny. And Danny had overdubbed his vocals, so he wasn't there when we tracked. I hadn't met him when we made the song. But then I was at the Echo for a show or something a few weeks later. And it's dark and loud there. And, you know, from watching the show, and in front of me through the crowd, like, walks the spitting image of George up to me.
Yeah.
And he puts his hand on my shoulder, and he says, "Hey, we haven't met. I'm Danny. I just sang on that track, and I just want you to know that my dad would have been really, really proud of the solo."
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And I fell apart.
You know? Yeah, I bet.
It was really cool.
Yeah.
And we've been friends since, that house in Brentwood, Tony's house, has been a kind of like a, I don't know, I'm sure there's a great term for the kind of you go back there and become re-enthused, you know.
Well, that but by doing that, like by being the kid who pulls it off, then other people are like, where's that guy? Who's that guy that was on that thing?
I think right? I think I've heard stories that like people would ask that, like if you heard somebody play on a record or something, and then they would ask him who it was, and he wouldn't say. He could keep it a secret.
Really?
Just keep it in his back pocket. I don't know if there's any truth to it, and I don't care.
What was the first time when it, you know, outside of like when he played that George Harrison thing? Because then mm-hmm. you got to lock into George's tone, and you want to respect that piece, and you want to, you know, honor that piece, right?
It wasn't even that. It was just the respecting the sort of beauty, innate beauty of the song. And,
right.
And that's all you really, I think, have to... Because I wasn't playing his solo,
right?
You know, I was doing something different,
uh-huh.
And I really feel like I've learned from getting to play with the people that I've gotten to play with, and the common denominator being that sort of heartfelt, like it doesn't really matter all that other stuff of like what was the amp and like
right.
you know, where do your ideas come from. All that bullshit is secondary to the thing that everybody tends to respond to, which is that kind of honesty, you know, and the confidence in what you're doing and musicality in it. Well, that's never been uncool, you know. I mean,
sure.
You know when Nirvana
and
was big,
you can feel it.
Yeah, and you know when Nirvana was big and like guitar solos were sort of uncool.
Yeah,
or that's the stigma in retrospect behind the band. There's guitar solos all over Nirvana records.
Yeah,
and they're beautiful and they're musical and they're more musical than the guitar solos that they were a departure from.
Right,
that were going on at that time.
And
you know?
How so? Because they're melodic and simple.
Yeah, they were melodic and simple, and there was a feeling behind them.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, yeah, that's... But
a
that's,
feeling.
Yeah, to trans... That's the... You got to transmit it.
Yes. And there was no feeling in the kind of like...
All the time. Yeah, well, you can feel... Like, even when you listen to like... If you listen to Albert King,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, even if you watch that stuff with Albert King and like Stevie Ray Vaughan,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, Albert is doing the limitations of what he does, and Stevie obviously started there but went somewhere else with it, you don't sit there and go like, no, he's getting his ass kicked. Because,
yeah.
you know, because the feeling
totally.
Is delivered.
Totally. It is. It's weird. It's this weird, like... withholding
yeah.
thing that has so much power in it.
Yeah.
And you know what? When I was 14 and heard that Derek Trucks record, that was something, I think that was the first time I'd ever heard such a clear example of how powerful that could be. You
yeah.
know? Like an electric guitar, an incredible electric guitar tone, and he's what he's doing with it and what he's not doing with it.
And you played with Lucinda? You toured with her?
I did,
for
yeah.
a lot of dates?
About a year.
Really?
On tour with her, yeah.
And that's a pretty raw band. Oh. She's like so fucking honest.
I mean, one of my favorite writers.
Yeah.
And was when I it wasn't the kind of thing where like I learned about her afterwards,
yeah.
you know? I mean, I really, my friend called me and said, "Hey," my friend Val McCallum was playing with her, and he said, "Hey, I can't make this tour. They're looking for a guitar player. Would you be interested?" I said, "Fuck yeah." You know,
yeah,
and I hate touring.
Yeah,
I really hate touring. And but there are a few artists that it's just like if you ever get the opportunity to go out and play with them, and she's one of them. And as a singer and as a writer, to get to have that kind of intimate relationship with that material,
yeah.
you know, and to learn it and to play it and hear
yeah.
how it evolves every night. And
wow.
I mean, that's a huge learning experience.
And you got along with her?
Yeah. Oh,
she's sweet.
Oh,
I talked to her once.
She's so great.
She's the best.
She's
the best.
So great.
And she really lets the music kind of stay raw.
Totally. I mean, she doesn't have a choice. I mean, her language, you know, that she uses is, there's no, there's nothing cerebral
no,
about
it's
it.
It's like right to the guts.
Yeah.
Did you see ZZ Top at the Greek?
No.
You didn't go?
No, I didn't.
You play with Billy, though? You play with Billy yeah. and Sweeney on that?
That's right. That was our first, I think.
On that Peter Green thing? What do you think of Peter
yes.
Green? How great is that guy?
So good.
What do you?
He's so good.
He's another one of those guys where you're just listening, and you're like, it's all the notes, you know where those notes are.
I know, but you've never heard him like that.
It's crazy.
I know, there's a lot of mystery in the way that he, I think.
You haven't figured it out?
No. No. I mean, there's some stuff that like I go, oh, wow, what a sound, you know,
yeah,
that I can
yeah.
produce. But the train of thought You know, like when he's on one of his, like, you know, flights of fancy,
yeah,
what he gets to with that.
It's so, it's like, and with his voice, it's like he takes, like, minor blues.
He was the guy who had everything everybody else wanted. And that band at that time.
Amazing.
They were one of the biggest bands in the world. And it's such an interesting legacy, the Fleetwood Mac legacy of, like, no other band has as many of the fucking rock and roll qualities. Like, biggest band in the world, we lose our lead singer and writer and founder, and then we get these, you know, we get two other guys, and then we become an even bigger band, yeah, right? And okay, well, other bands have done that before, whatever, like maybe you got the AC/DC, yeah, but nobody in AC/DC was fucking each other,
right?
And like, there weren't these like interrelationships and just the story of that band
so
is
different. The bands that the Peter Green Fleetwood Mac, and then
so
the,
different.
The Walsh, I didn't love the Welsh, what's his name?
The guy who passed?
No.
Well,
no.
There were a few.
No, there was, yeah, I listened
Kirwan,
to
him. The Kiln House.
He was great. That's a great record.
Beautiful.
I love that record. Yeah. He's not alive anymore? Kirwan? I think he is.
I don't know.
And the other guy, Danny, and then there's Spencer, Jeremy Spencer,
right,
was the original rhythm guitar player with Peter Green.
Oh, I didn't know.
And then Kirwan came in.
Yeah.
And then, why am I forgetting his name? Welsh or Walsh? Not Walsh. Ah, fuck.
Welsh sounds kind of familiar.
Welsh, yeah, Bob Welsh.
Bob Welsh.
He came in after Kirwan left.
Yeah.
And then, like, they were looking, that's part of that whole Sound City thing. They were at Sound City, Mick Fleetwood and McVie, uh-huh, and they were looking for a guitar player, and they were listening to mixes of the Buckingham Nicks record,
yeah,
and said, well, ask Buckingham.
We gotta get this dude.
And he said, yeah, you can if you take my girl, and that's how that happened.
Yeah.
But did you watch that documentary, Man of the World, about the Peter Green?
Oh, no, I
dude,
haven't seen it yet.
It's on. Go on Netflix. A BBC.
I will.
Not on Netflix. It's on.
It's hard for me to watch music stuff.
No, but it's like.
I bet it's great.
But the thing is like, you go to you just go on YouTube and look for Peter Green, Man of the World. It's a BBC thing, and some guy.
Maybe I have seen it.
Well,
I've
some
seen
dude,
Peter
some
Green
writer found him, sort of rotting away in a mental hospital, over medicated, got him back on his feet. You know, and pulled it together, and then interviewed McVie and Jeremy Spencer and Mick Fleetwood about what happened to Peter Green.
Right.
And he's this little old man now, and he's like cognizant, and he's, you know, he's together, and they all track it back to this one night in Berlin at a
with
party.
An axe? Right.
Didn't he have an axe? No.
That was Skip's fence.
No. It was some party where he got dosed.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, they all build up to this moment where he goes downstairs with these people and they're jamming. And like Spencer's like, I didn't want to go down there. Some weird sounds. Something evil was going on.
Yeah.
And then the guy finally, after they build this thing up, the guy asked Peter Green, like, what about that night in Berlin? He's like, no, I think we sound pretty good. didn't even register.
So sick.
Dude, I love that guy.
He's the king. And how beautiful is it to put a band together and name it after the bass player and drummer?
Yeah, he had this fundamental, he was humble, and he didn't want, I don't think he ever wanted to be, you know, he just wanted to, like, I've never heard someone feel so hard as that guy with his singing and his playing.
And writing.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
All right, let's do some tricks.
Okay. So, that shape, the pentatonic shape, let's say we're in B, you know, B minor. Yeah. So that box. Now, what if you, instead of that sort of fixed kind of, okay, here's that bottom fret, that thing. What if instead you ventured a fret down, but you bent a half step up?
Yeah.
All of a sudden, you start to lose that kind of boxy sound
being,
you know, and it becomes a, you're taking advantage of what a guitar can do that a piano and so many other instruments can't.
Yeah.
You know, drums, you get this vocal quality. I mean, I think I first heard the mixing and matching of that pentatonic stuff when I was like. And I was like on the shitter or something, and on Instagram looking at people's photos, and somebody had posted a picture of this record that looked really interesting, the cover of it. And it was this, and I don't totally know how to pronounce her name yet, but I'll sound it out. T-S-E-G-U-E.
T-S-E-G-U-E.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sege or something mm-hmm. like that.
Sounds good.
Miriam Jebru.
Wow.
M-A-R-Y-A-M G-E-U G-U-E, sorry, B-R-O-U.
Mm-hmm.
And she's this Ethiopian piano player, and you know, somebody's going to place one of these songs in a movie, and it's going to be the most sentimental scene, you know, of 2015.
Yeah.
But this record is, and the, I mean, just the titles of the songs, The Homeless Wanderer, The Last Tears of a Deceased,
huh.
The Madman's Laughter, you know?
Wow.
Ballad of the Spirits, Homesickness.
So what did this tell you? How did it speak
uplifting
to you?
Stuff.
Yeah.
It's that color. It just, she just dances around in these rooms,
uh-huh.
you know? Like these,
well, just
kind of
looking at
rooms.
It as a room is like, you know, I think helpful
yeah.
to me.
It's an environment.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like a painting. It's a choice selection of colors.
And you find this out when you, do you find that you make most of your discoveries alone with your instrument, with the instrument?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, some things you definitely hone in the live setting. It's kind of fun.
Well, why don't we do one song from the record and wrap
sure.
it up? I like that thing you do with yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I could do that one. This was a tune that is based on this Howlin' Wolf groove, 44 Blues,
do yeah.
you know that track? So then in that song, they've got the upright bass playing this bass line and the guitar doubling it and a piano doing the kind of pretty chords on the top and it kind of amps between two chords, two and a half chords almost, like they go to the five in a cool way. It's sort of a half five.
Yeah.
And then back to, you know, it's a blues progression. So I thought, well, what if that bass line were part of a progression that had a few more chords in it and some piano moves and things like that. You know, stuff that's a little out of the wheelhouse of blues music, but still has that kind of like familiarity of that bass line and the feel.
Yeah,
and
I
stuff,
knew there was something know? Haunting about
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, that was great.
It's been a second since I've had to use my voice, but
that sounded great, fun. Man. Thanks cool. so much for doing this.
My pleasure.
The album's called
Hi Ho.
Hi Ho. It's a big, beautiful record. Two big old discs.
Yes, you know how
vinyl,
how
big plates.
We put all this money into making this record sound good, and then listen to it on Spotify one day, and it's
Well, get thing. Both.
Yeah, get both. Yeah, yeah, that'll be the day.
Thanks, yeah. Blake.
Thanks, dude.
That's it. That's our show. That was pretty intense, wasn't it? That jam. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. Get your justcoffee.coop over there. They got a bunch of new... I told you about the new machine. Get the WTF blend. I get a little on the back end of that. Yeah. Oh, shit. Marin on IFC. That premieres on the 14th of May. I know. I didn't realize some of you were so hostile about cable. Watch it however you want. What else? I'm not going to play guitar. Not after that. Come on, man. Boomer lives!